So let me add my bit. I'm happy to take questions, but let's keep it polite, okay? I want to thank Kurt for the opportunity to come and talk to this crowd today. I'm going to talk on what I call density-dependent implicit solvent potentials. This is not actually a very new story. This is some work we did a couple of years ago. So many of you may have seen this before. I don't know. For those of you who haven't, though, I think this is a good venue with which to bring it back up again. It's a topic that I worked on with one student, Eric Allen, a couple of years ago that, going through this sort of a toy problem, I found very illuminating on certain aspects of coarse graining, and maybe I can share some of that with you today. So my plan is to talk a little bit to reorient us all on the problem I'm going to apply this problem to, which is self-assembly. Then we're going to focus on what I really think is the heart of the matter here, which is the development of these potentials that I'll just call density-dependent implicit solvent potentials. And then finally, in the last part of this, I'll apply this to a surfactant system to show you to what extent it works. And again, I want to, full disclosure, this is not hot off the press. You can find everything I'm going to talk about here in this set of papers that goes back a couple of years. So self-assembly is a class of problems. It pops up in many places. There's a lot of biological examples of this in protein folding and things going through lipid bilayers. But what I'm really referring to here is the tendency for certain systems to spontaneously and reversibly organize into ordered structures involving non-covalent interactions. And so the kind of physical problems that interested me and led me in this direction was I'm very interested in crystallization of polymers from dilute solution, and I think those fall into this category. This is an example of a Brownian dynamic simulation by Muthukumar at UMass that studied this problem. But it's not necessarily the easiest version of it. Maybe a more canonical type of problem is this idea of self-assembly into micellar phases. And so that, I think, is the problem we chose to try to apply this coarse graining set of potentials to. So I'll orient you a little bit on what that is. What I'm talking about here is the simulation of amphiphiles in solution. So I've got a solvent molecule that I have to deal with. I've got an amphiphile which has a head group which likes the solvent and a tail group which does not like the solvent. I have to worry about how these different groups interact with the solvent as well as with each other. And above a particular concentration, the critical micelle concentration, these things tend to self-organize into these micelles. And so you get very close interactions between tail and tail and head groups, so they're not, when they're not completely dispersed in solvent. Typical aggregation numbers can vary, but they're normally on the order of a few tens of surfactant molecules. And it's also important how these micelles might interact with each other. So I don't want to necessarily do a system where I just have one micelle in a box. I might want to be interested in how micelles can exchange surfactants between each other. Okay? The other important thing to realize is that in real systems, this critical micelle concentration is typically on the order of a few micromolar to millimolar. So these are very dilute systems in which this transition happens. And so when you're doing a simulation of this guy close to the CMC, most of the time you're simulating water or the solvent. When you really, the interesting part tends to be the micelle or the surfactants themselves. The other thing I want to point out about this is that this CMC concentration is related to the free energy of micellization. So if we get even approximately close with the CMC, that must mean we're doing really darn well with the free energy piece. Now, at the time we were doing this, a typical atomistic simulation looked something like this, which was to take a collection of molecules and, in some insightful way, glom them together into a single object and let them wiggle around in a big box of water. This would be about, in this particular case, it was about a 10,000 atom simulation. But it becomes prohibitively expensive to try to do this with multiple micelles. And the time, and you don't typically just throw the surfactants into the box and then watch them self-assemble, because it takes a fair amount of time for these things to actually assemble into a micelle, much less exchange surfactants between different micelles. And the main reason for this is because while you're simulating this object, you've got 97-98% of your simulation is the solvent moving around, and so you might think that that's something you try to get rid of. And of course, these are called implicit solvent simulations. Now, to my mind, when I think about coarse graining, there's basically two strategies one can take, both of which involve throwing away some number of degrees of freedom and then paying the penalty for that, and hopefully keeping that penalty as small as possible. In a lot of these approaches, We take some set of, let's say this is an atomistic or detailed fine-grained simulation, and we'll aggregate the particles into larger particles, okay? Just without intuition, perhaps, or maybe with intuition, but in some ingenious way, we'll take all these particles and aggregate them into bigger particles and throw away the information within these little clusters. And that's one approach, and this is typified, I think, by something like DPD simulation, where you have these soft core objects that otherwise run around like regular dynamical objects. But another approach is to say, is to look at this and say, well, I've got interesting degrees of freedom and uninteresting degrees of freedom. Let me just coarsen out all the uninteresting ones and focus on the interesting ones. And that's basically taking these solvent molecules and then smearing them out and just keeping, with full resolution, the interesting objects, okay? And this is what I call an implicit solvent type of coarse graining. But these share certain features. In both cases, I'm throwing away certain degrees of freedom. I've got to reparameterize the potentials between the remaining degrees of freedom so that they capture the effect of some of that, those missing degrees of freedom. And I basically have a trade-off between how well I can approximate. I'm losing some information, and I'm trying to introduce a new potential so that that lost information is approximated in some intelligent way. So before I do that for this density-dependent type potential, let me digress a little bit just to show you a calculation we did in another context that I think is a little bit illuminating. This was some work done by another student, Ahmed Ishmael, a few years previously, where we said, let's be really unintelligent about this. Let's have no intuition. Let's just do a systematic coarse graining of our system using some kind of signal processing technique. And a nice test case for this was a set of wavelets which have the feature that they are orthonormal functions, and they are localized both in the original space and the transform space, and they can completely represent your system in a new transform set of degrees of freedom. So an example of this, we used Haar wavelets, which is, again, the simplest ones, applied to a 2D Ising model. My original model might look something like this, where I've gotten some number of sites that are occupied or spin up, or whatever you like. And in applying the wavelet transformation, I apply an averaging function and a differencing function and come up with a new set of degrees of freedom. So I've had my original degrees of freedom are U, and I'll transform those to a set of averages S and a set of differences delta. In this two-dimensional case, what I do is I actually transform this from n degrees of freedom, in this case 16, to n over 4 averages and 3n over 4 differences. Okay? And so I've kept all the information up to this point, but then I might say, let's coarse grain this. Typically, we keep the averages, we throw away the differences, or we approximate the differences in some way. And that somehow is typical of many of coarse graining procedures that I see out in the literature. So we can do that. Let's just throw away all those differences and keep only the averages and say that's our core, systematically coarse grained system by this hard wavelet transformation. And let's look and see what it does to our phase space. So here's my original system. Let's say I've got 4 sites that I'm going to coarse into a single site. And here's the phase space of this Ising model for this 4-site system. I can write down a partition function for that in terms of the original Hamiltonian. I've got to integrate over the original phase space. I'm going to go from a case where I've got 4 sites, any one of which can take one of 2 values, to a single site, which can take one of 5 values. So the spin state, if you will, has become more complex, but the number of degrees of freedom has reduced. But what's, I think, more important here is if you look at the mapping between the phase space here and the phase space here, you can see it's not equal, right? This guy represents a single configuration, whereas he represents 6 configurations. And so by simply throwing away the differences and just keeping the averages, I've made a huge transformation of the phase volumes associated with each of these configurations. So if I just write down my new Hamiltonian as an exponential of, let's say, my new partition function, as a function of the new Hamiltonian, I'm going to miss all that. So what we introduce is a weighting factor out front that's supposed to count the relative importance of these different new states. So for example, what we did, we said, well, let's just count the degeneracy of the number of states and use that as our weighting function. At least that will work at high temperature, and our Hamiltonian will work at low temperature, and then in the middle, we'll have some sort of approximation. But that's the basic idea, and I think this is a to me, a very insightful thing, because now you remember that when you're coarse graining, you need to think about whether you're throwing away equal amounts of phase space as you coarse grain different parts of your system, apparently in the same way, but not necessarily. One other nice feature of the wavelet transformation is that it can be applied recursively. So I can start off with something which has, let's say, a 4x4 set of blocks, each block one large. I can apply a transformation to get that to be a 2x2 set of blocks, and I can transform it a second time and have a single block. And in terms of the averages, these are all the same. But of course, this is a much more coarse-grained system relative to that one. If I keep the differencing operators, I can walk right back up in the other direction. Now, of course, I'm not going to keep the differencing operators. I'm going to throw those away and approximate those with that degeneracy factor. But I will take advantage of this basic multi-resolution feature to suggest, well, we use this to suggest a sort of a wavelet-accelerated Monte Carlo procedure, where instead of simulating this system at full resolution or something like it, we simulate at some intermediate resolution. The boxes are actually much bigger than 4x4s. They might be substantially larger Monte Carlo blocks. And then we'll use a Monte Carlo simulation to sample the degeneracy for each of these, and then perform the simulation on this lattice, this reduced lattice size. And in that way, we can estimate both the degeneracy WS and then the sampling of the Hamiltonian, the exponential of H of S. And so here's what such a simulation in the Ising model looks like. Here's our original system. In this case, I guess it was a 32 by 32 Ising model. If we just transform that to, I guess this is 8 blocks, 4 on a side, you see what I'm saying. You lose some part of phase space. You lose some entropy. So as you go at low temperature, there's no problem because they have the same ground state. But at high temperature, you lose parts of phase space. But if you put back in the degeneracies, reweight all the states according to the degeneracies, you can recover that full entropy at high temperature. Now, of course, they still disagree at intermediate temperature. And if you look at something like magnetization, so here's our original model. This is the magnetization transition from disordered to ordered. You see, you get the two high and low temperature states, but you don't get the right transition temperature because you haven't exactly correctly accounted for all the relative weightings of otherwise identical states on the coarse grain scale, which are not exactly equivalent on the fine grain scale. But since this is a multi-resolution and reversible technique, you can imagine having an adaptive simulation where when you're far from a transition, you use a fairly coarse-grained simulation. We used this is now a 64 by 64 Ising model, so we simulated as 8 blocks, each representing 8 spins on a side, which is fairly fast. As we cool down or heat up, as you begin to approach something like a phase transition, you can detect this by looking at fluctuations, right? As fluctuations get large near a transition, if you monitor those, you can say, oh, we're getting too close to a transition. Maybe I better fine grain my simulation to get to find out where this transition actually is. And so you can see the simulation can dynamically adapt itself by increasing its resolution to 16 blocks to 32 blocks, and finally to the full 64 by 64 simulation in order to catch the transition. So this was an example, I think, of an adaptive multi-resolution type simulation. The line here is the analytical solution for the two-dimensional Ising model. So you can see we fall right on that. But the important thing I want to get across to you here is that you need to account for this degeneracy or something like that when reweighting your fine-grained states to coarse-grained states. So I want to take advantage of that, and I want to come back to the implicit solvent problem and take advantage of that idea. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a fine-grained system like this of particles, and we're going to smooth out all the blue particles, the solvent particles, keeping all the red particles. So here's my original partition function. I'll separate it out into integral over the solute molecules and the solvent molecules, and I'll integrate out all the solvent molecules to smooth this out. So I end up with some new effective potential that depends upon the solute interactions and the solute-solvent interactions. And then all the solvent-solvent interactions show up as some prefactor on this partition function. Now what we'll do is we'll say, well, hey, why don't we just take this prefactor, whatever it is, we don't know its magnitude necessarily a priori, and let's repartition it into n equal parts and put it back into the effective potential. And if you do that, you end up with a term that's density dependent, That looks like a chemical potential for the particles of the remaining explicitly described solutes. So now I've got this integral just over the solute. We've obtained interesting solute molecules. And it looks like a new Hamiltonian. And then all it comprises of is the effective potential that I normally would look for when coarse graining, which I'll call the two-body term. And this has the nice feature that if I do this correctly, I can reproduce the structure. I can map that so that it reproduces the structure of the detailed atomistic simulation, but not necessarily the energy. But I've also got this one-body term that I can fit to something else. I call it mu for a reason. We're going to map this to reproduce the chemical potential of insertion of these solute particles into the background solvent. So I basically created a only slightly more complicated force field. We've got the usual two-body part, and now we're going to have a one-body part. Not that hard. They're density dependent because as the density of solute changes, so does the amount of solvent that I remove. So this integral has to represent a different amount of number of degrees of freedom. So I expect this pre-factor to vary with how much material I integrate out. But once I do that, I can make sure this will allow me to fit chemical potentials, and this will allow me to fit structure. You could ask, well, so should we fit this these potentials to a global density or to a local density? At the time we did this, we didn't know the answer to this. A lot more has been learned about this since then. Certainly, fitting to a global density is the easy thing to do. And one can get a very quick estimate of the necessary chemical potential to reproduce the excess chemical potential on the fine scale or atomistic scale. But there is some pathological behavior in terms of whether or not these things actually produce correct equations of state. And more importantly, they're not sensitive to inhomogeneities in the system, which a micelle certainly would be. So we didn't want to really go that route. So instead, we use this as a learning step to get estimates for chemical potentials. And then we went to a local density dependent function where we could now introduce a localization function W, and we tried different ones of this. This can be a square wave or a linear or a quadratically decaying function. Turns out it really didn't matter too much for us, but this is some sort of localization that counts the amount of solvent, if you will, locally around, or actually counts the amount of solute around another solute particle. But we use that to say something about how much solvent was there as well. And we're also hoping that this will be more transferable. So let's do that. So here's our implementation. We're going to take a set of short simulations, and we're going to simulate them for different particles that we expect to be represented in our surfactants. We're not going to worry about bonding these together at first. These are going to be simple particle and solvent type simulations. We'll then fit these we'll then remove all the solvent and determine the effective potential, VF, as well as the effective potential and the chemical potential at each density of solute required to reproduce the original atomistic system. Well, this is a standard united atom model, but I think this is as you'll see, I'm going to just use Leonard Jonesium type things. I'm not going to actually simulate this particular chain. This was drawn as an example. But I don't think it's limited to this particular united atom picture. In fact, that's not what we did. So here's what we do. We're going to have our initial guess at the effective potential, which we're going to take as we've already done a fully atomistic simulation, so we can invert that pair distribution function to get a mean field potential. We'll then do a simulation in the coarse grain system and get some true pair distribution function, and then we'll look at how close those match. And in a conventional technique that's already been referred to earlier, we traced it back to Chalmers, but it's been reinvented a couple of times, including by ourselves. But basically, you can iterate through this process by updating your estimate over some number of iterations to get a completely well-matched, find the effective potential that exactly matches your fine-grained pair distribution function. So this allows us to reproduce structure with the two-body part of our potential. And then we go in afterwards and say, so now we have that, let's do some particle insertions into the fine grain simulation, and then from that get an excess chemical potential and ask the question, now how much would this one body term have to be in order to correctly reproduce that insertion potential? And we can do this for different densities of solutes in an otherwise solvent system. So when you do all that, here's what our density-dependent type potentials look like. Over a range of solute densities, I've got a value for the chemical potential for the one body term, and then I've got, as a function of distance, I've got the two body term. And we do this numerically, so this generates a table of values, but I suppose one could fit an analytical function to these as well, if one were so inclined. We just use it as a table lookup potential. So then we want to test this idea to see how well it works. Here's what we did first, simplest idea. Let's suppose we've got a homogeneous system of blue particles. They're all the same, Lennard-Jonesian. If this is right, then we ought to be able to coarsen out. So we're not relying upon any separation of time scale or anything like that here. We're just removing particles that we're not interested in and looking at the remainder. So I can remove different amounts of these particles by coarsening them out, and so I get different densities of solute, all of which should be representing the same system. So that's what this is. Here's the details of the Lennard-Jonesian if you care to see it. And over this whole range, we can get excellent fits of the RDF. This is the worst case scenario. I don't remember which density this was for, but it really doesn't matter. You can see they're all right smack on the that original pair distribution function for the original system. Here's our excess chemical potential over a range of densities. You see it fluctuates a bit, but that's largely due to our numerical efforts to converge that quantity. You can see the scale here is fairly small. So you can get pretty good representation of the excess chemical potential over the whole range of coarsening densities, as well as the effective the pair distribution function. So then you can ask the question, so what do these potentials look like once you've constructed them? Let's look at the effective potential first. When you're at very low density, low density, that's the blue curve. This looks very much like the potential of mean force. This is inserting, looking at the interaction between two sites where everything else has been, I mean, it's still supposed to be there, but it's been coarse-grained out. As you increase the density of solute, you're transferring information from the background effective potential back to the original solute-solute potential, and so this mean field potential converges towards the original Lennard-Jones potential at high density. If you look at the one-body term, at low density, the one-body term has to equal the excess chemical potential, because if you're inserting one particle into something that has no other particles into it, but it's supposed to represent a lot of particles, then that one particle insertion has to carry with it all of the excess chemical potential. But as you increase the density, so it actually stays there for at that value for quite a range of density for whatever reason. But as you approach full occupancy and where the density of the solute is the true density, this value should start to approach towards zero, because now the energy of insertion is entirely captured by the two-body term, and you don't need the one-body term at all. There's a wrinkle to this problem that I will show up, I think, in later plots. These values won't actually go exactly to zero at one, and that's because we're not actually inserting an n plus one particle in an n particle system. We're inserting an n particle and removing enough solvent at the same time to give it space to occupy. So that's a little bit different from a true particle insertion. And so that's why these values don't go to one exactly at density equal to one. So anyway, that's the case for the simplest system of coarsening like particles. Now if we want to go to surfactants, we need to introduce different types of particles. So I'll introduce a solvophilic particle and a solvophobic particle. I'll call those B and C. And in both those cases, I can simulate over a range of concentrations of, let's say, the solvophilic particle, and then I can coarsen out all the solvent. And if I do that, I can look at, fit the RDFs. They fit very well. I can look at the fit to the excess chemical potential. Those vary between the insertion of a solvophilic particle into pure solvent down here, and up here would be the insertion of a solvophilic particle into a melt of itself. And so you get a nice fit to the all atom potentials of the line, and our coarse-grained fits are the symbols that are plotted here. And the structure of the one and two body potentials are very similar. In this case, let's see, we see over here the solvophilic has a little bit lower well, which means it's less strongly attracted to itself compared to the solvophobic, which is more strongly attracted to itself, and therefore C are more likely to aggregate together in a solve in a C of A than a couple of B sites are. And this is also reflected in the chemical potential function, which looks like the one I showed you before. Assertion of a B particle into pure A is negative for when B likes A, and is positive when C doesn't like A, and then they have to go to some other value as they as the density changes. So that's the basic idea between our potentials. So these are implicit solvent simulations. What's new about it, I think, is that we've argued you need to introduce a one-body term and a two-body term if you want to get both the structure and the energetics. At least the two terms will give you the opportunity to fit two different things like that when deriving the potential. And so we chose to reproduce excess chemical potential and the structure as described by the radial distribution function. We did look at a lot of transferability of this. I'm not going to go into those details today because I don't think I have time. But we can talk about those later if you want to, what happens when you put these together in chains and so forth. But also works for unlike particles. So with the time I have left, let me apply this to a simple surfactant model. This is one which has been in the literature for a while. In fact, there are some nice simulations with this model where semi-grand canonical Monte Carlo simulations have been used to actually look at the free energy and get the micellar size distribution over some range of micell sizes, very extensive calculations of that sort. In this particular model, the interaction potential is a truncated shifted Lennard-Jones potential, and the tail group is made so that it doesn't like the solvent or the head group by just truncating it, the attractive interactions at a shorter distance. And then to ensure that you get a spherical micell instead of something lamellar or fancy like that, the head group is made a little bit larger. Here we go. The sigma for the head group is made a little bit larger so that it tends to introduce curvature into the surfactant layer. And so you expect to get, that will impose some constraint on how big the equilibrium micells are. So now we need to parameterize what we'll call water, tail, and head groups. And we do this exactly by the procedure I just showed you. So here's our head and tail one body terms, chemical potentials. Here's our best fit to the G of R, the radial distribution function for the head groups, which disperse very nicely in the solvent. This is very easy to do. You can see we don't do so well when we put in tail groups because they tend to aggregate. And we have implicitly suggested that we're fitting these conditions under assuming that the box is essentially homogeneous, so we don't have pre-aggregation during the fitting process. This caused us some consternation for a while until we realized that the source of this was this truncated shifted potential, which we truncated and shifted every column of V effective the same independently. When we changed that and truncated them to different amounts, we found we could exactly fit this the tail, the G of R, even for the tails. Okay. Don't know exactly why that was, but we tried it. It worked, and so there's probably some good lesson to be had there. So let's look at the potentials. So here's our tail group. It's got a large chemical potential at dilute solution because it doesn't like to be there, whereas the head group is very attractive to the solution. So these look very similar to what I showed you for our B and C solvophobic, solvophilic groups. Interestingly, so the effective potentials look very much like these Lennard-Jones. The interesting thing with the head group is because of its size, it tends to have a corona of water around it, and so it has this soft shoulder on it in the effective potential. I know my time is short, so I'm going to jump ahead to the so now we've got to the actual application of this to a problem. So we want to look at for the CMC. So we'll take these effective potentials, and we will simulate different numbers of surfactants into different sizes of boxes. Keep the number of surfactants the same and change the box size is equivalent to changing concentration of surfactant. And we just count the number of free surfactants versus the total number of surfactants. And below the critical micelle concentration, this follows the parity line. And then as soon as you start to form micelles, you don't get a whole bunch of new free surfactants. And so where this deviates from the parity line, you know you've got micelles forming. And so this was our test. And if you look at the simulations, you can actually see where we've kind of highlighted. We use a clustering algorithm to identify where these micelles are. And all this is happening dynamically, well, not dynamically, but we're using a Monte Carlo simulation. So these are all happening spontaneously as we equilibrate at each density. This case is for a single head with four tail beads. In the original pool paper, they also did a single head with five tail beads. So this is what I showed you before. This is the new system. And again, you get the right critical micelle concentration. So here's the all-atom simulations done by Poole and Bolhaus. And here's our implicit solvent simulations. And you can see we're within about 20% of the critical micelle concentration. So with these fitted potentials, now this is not a this is not an explicit atom type simulation. These are toy models, amplifiers. But to the extent that we approximate those by throwing away all the solvent, we get a pretty good representation of the original. We can also look at the full range of aggregation behaviors. So you can see, if you look at the aggregation numbers, they're very similar to the all-atom case. Long tails. Excellent speed up. We can't do the size of systems that I just showed you on the previous slide with the full detailed atomistic model, but we'd estimate it would take something under 10 to the 7th days with the kind of computer speeds we had 5 years ago. It took us 2 days to do our own simulations. I've been told to stop talking, so I'll put this up for you to look at and read in your leisure. I guess the 2 points I'd like you to take home is that I think there's some insightful information to be gained from looking at systematic coarse graining procedures, because they show you what needs to happen when you try to retain as much information as possible in a coarse grained effective Hamiltonian. But also, I think this leads to a very simple model form that might be of practical use for people developing coarse grain potential. We don't seem to include very often this one body term, and yet I think it could be very helpful to improving the quality of some of our simulations. And with that, I'll stop and thank you for your attention. I can hear you fine. Well, you've got to be recorded.
Pass it out for you.
All right. For the micelle simulations, did you have to do anything special to get the equilibrium distribution? I imagine this is very difficult because of the high energy, free energy barriers that you have to overcome.
No, we didn't have to do anything special. We've got a large, well, so the resistance to overcoming that barrier, remember the solvent is completely gone.
Yeah.
So these are basically freely diffusing surfactants, and there's actually doesn't seem to be a huge dynamical, there's no dynamical barrier. We're not doing dynamics.
Okay.
We try different.
So it just comes out, you just let it run and it comes out like that?
It's a straight Metropolis Monte Carlo.
Mm-hmm.
I had a quick question. You said something about making the potentials work by changing the truncations,
yeah.
And that was very fast.
Very
I didn't
confused.
Really understand what you did and why. Did okay. you just say you made them different size spheres or something?
No. Let me. I did go by that fast. It's a rather technical point. It's one I could easily have glossed over entirely. But since I brought it up and you asked, let me go back to that. So remember that the original system is using a truncated shifted Leonard-Jones potential. So we adopted that as well in our effective potential. We assume they would all be truncated shifted potentials. That's not a problem when you have homogeneous systems. But when you have inhomogeneous systems, you're trying to fit a potential to configurations that already have variations in local density. Okay, that's the observation I had. Actually, not I, Eric had. And we could not, at the same time we were fitting effective potentials which were truncated and shifted. All of them shifted to zero at the same cutoff.
So then you just dropped the constraint on your.
Then we dropped that constraint, and we let that shifting go free, and it turns out as long as these can all shift to zero, but we had a couple of potentials, a couple of densities where that didn't work, and these are the densities where low density solutes. So this would be the case where you'd see the least amount of aggregation, I think. But that's what we saw.
I have two questions. First of all, shouldn't your optimal one body and two body potentials be also a function of temperature?
Oh, yes, yes. These are all coarse-grained effective potentials, and so they're state point dependent, absolutely. I did not go into the transferability tests we did here, but we have looked at these to transfer them to different temperatures. How well do you get the original atomistic simulation at a different temperature, and of course they start to fail as you go too far away from the fitting temperature. I can give you numbers for that. We thought that with I don't remember the percentage error, but it might have, like for 1% error in some metrics we were calculating, you could go about a 10% deviation in temperature. Okay, but I think we're fit over the whole range of density, so that's probably okay. There's probably still a dependence on the total system density. That needs to be included here. But yes, like any other coarse-grained effective potential, they're state-point dependent.
Okay, and then my other question, the chemical potential curves that you have, they have a minimum in there. I was wondering if you have if that has a significance to it.
So I think, let me go to this. Was that an example of it? That's not a good example of it. I don't think that minimum is significant. I think that's at the level of our error, our ability to estimate what these potentials are. I think you're referring to an earlier one, like maybe this one. You know, is that an important minimum? Is there some information in that? I'm not convinced that there is. I think if we had error bars on this plot, we'd find that was more or less a straight line. Or at least if there is significance, we haven't figured out what it is yet. I don't know.
This is for Leonard Jones, though.
This is Leonard Jonesians, yeah. This happens.
Have you?
Go ahead.
Have you considered applying this to something like, you know, ionic or non-ionic surfactant in water? Then what kind of trouble will the chemical potential calculation give you?
Well, so these are non-ionic surfactants we've applied them to.
Not in water.
Well. My single site water, I think I'm still probably okay on that.
But that's really the issue. What about hydration?
Yeah. Well, so for example, okay, I'll give you an example of hydration. It's in here. I mentioned it.
Hydration with directional bonds.
This is a hydration shell. Okay. This is the cutoff of the head group, and this shoulder is because I've coarsened out solvent, but there tends to be in the real system a corona or a hydration cell of solvent. So I think hydration cell is not the issue. That can be captured in the effective potential. The more complicated thing, and note that we've thought about, haven't done anything about, is what happens when you have charges in here. Okay, and that would be an obvious next step here. We haven't done it. I think it would work. I think there are some additional considerations, such as you got to keep a charge-neutral system if you're going to start looking at these densities. Things have to be treated properly with respect to charge. But I don't have a reason to think it would break yet.
I was wondering, what's the significance of the measured pair correlation function in a system that has locally phase-separated? If you take a system at the same density, but let's say 10 times as many particles, these clusters would be bigger, and probably your measured pair correlation functions would show more structure.
So you're referring to the system where we had difficulty fitting the potential, right?
Yes.
That's the only time we saw that was when we were trying to parameterize tail groups in solvent. And you're right, I don't think it makes a lot of sense. So I think in that case, we did not go through the practice of parameterizing mu initially on the global potential, of the global density. We parameterize it directly by looking at local densities. Again, I went through some things fast here, but what we found it expedient to do was to first parameterize mu on global density, because then you can collect a lot of data and you have to fit one scalar value. And then we use that, so now you've got potential as a function of density, and now you run one simulation where you're parametering on local density, you need to have that whole vector of of chemical potentials to fit for that simulation, to reparameterize chemical potentials for local density. We just use the global potentials as an initial guess for that. When we fit the partially tending to aggregate tail groups, we skip that stage of global, the initial stage of estimating what the global density, because I think it makes no sense.
Yes, question. I assume one of your particles is at one local density, and for another particle you have another local density.
Yeah.
Which potential you have?
We had to make a mixing rule.
Okay.
And I don't remember exactly what that mixing rule was. It was not as simple as taking the average of the two potentials. It was more a matter of taking the. It was more complicated than that. It was that basic philosophy. We looked at some increments in effective potentials and averaged those increments. Yeah.
I have a question. If I compare your density-dependent term to what is often done in implicit solvent protein models when they evaluate for a given bead the momentarily solvent accessible surface area of a bead, would that be a comparable magnitude of correction?
The solvent accessible surface area?
Yeah, basically that's isn't that to some extent also the hydration of a given bead, whether it is solvent accessible or not solvent accessible?
Yeah, but I think this is better than solvent accessible, because what we actually can capture with this simulation is not just hydration shells, but partially solvated. So we can have a situation where you can have, I mean, really, you can have a site that has different amounts of not just proximate solvent, but included. I could draw a picture and I could describe it, but it's a.
I understand. I wasn't suggesting that it's the same thing. I was more referring to if you compare now the magnitude of the change that you get through this one body term to a typical, would that be of the same order of magnitude?
You know, I don't know the answer to that because I haven't seen that. We didn't do that comparison. That might be a tough comparison to make. I don't know.
You
have to ask Mike that.
Okay, let's thank Jeff again. Our next speaker is Dr. Stockholm, Alexander Lubatsev. And about inverse Monte Carlo, and we need this.
Okay. My talk will be about systematic constraining of molecular models by the inverse Monte Carlo. And I will not talk long about the necessity of constraining. You can see similar scheme on almost any talk on multiscale modeling. This is some other view on constraining. You have here a clear picture, and if you want to save computer resources, you can compress it. You see this picture without